to get going here, just to kick it off, we are doing a Master Trust conference call. This is a call that we're doing for really just program folks this time around. You had a training earlier this month, which I hope most of you have reviewed, or if you go to the website, you can review. It's in video format. It was presented by the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County. Bill Booth, John, and Jim Walsh, they do a great job there for kids. They drill into these issues quite a bit. Bill has done a lot of litigation in this area, and they did an initial training for us regarding these master trust accounts that these kids have. It's exciting to be drilling into this issue. Traditionally, it's not something that on a statewide level we have drilled into or we have focused on, so it's really fertile ground for us to move into. I can assure you we have a couple of people out there that have drilled into the weeds. They've done some really good work on this. We'll talk about some of that here in a few minutes. But the bottom line with it all is that I think you all know that children do receive property, and they do have funds that go to the department and the CBCs that are held for them. And when they receive these funds, they're to be used for their needs, their short and their long-term needs. And I'll refer to some statutory sections as we talk here. I'll try to give them to you. But as I do, keep in mind that we're going to be creating some documents to follow this training that will give you the specifics of what I'm talking about in terms of where you'll find the sites for where these rules come from. So we do intend to follow it up with some tangible things that you can have. Before I go any further, though, I would like to just say to you that when you drill into these issues and you come across a complicated issue, or you get stiff resistance from the department or CBCs or any resistance at all, please contact us. You can contact our regional attorney, and your supervising attorney knows how to do that. You can contact Domery Farmer. She'll be able to pipe you into what we to the folks that can help you get it on track if you need some help. Or you can always talk to Tom, the Tom Young, our appellate attorney. I think that it would just be better and quicker if you went through the regional attorney, and again, your supervising attorneys know how to do that. But just know this, even if you are encountering a problem and you don't feel that you have a practice aid or you don't feel it was covered in training, please pick up the phone and call us, and we will definitely help you get to a point where we can start dealing with it. So with that being said, in looking at how the Department of Children and Families and the CBCs have to handle this, it's kind of a unique situation for them. Unique, but it's not. They're constantly in these situations where they are both a state party and trying to look out for the child. Well, in this situation, under 402.17, which is a statutory section that primarily is dealing with the origination of master trust accounts, coming from a legislative point of view, they literally have the dual responsibility of preserving money for the state and acting like a normal fiduciary for a person that they are a trustee for. And so with that in mind, there is a statutory section that also requires them to bring the matter before the court if they feel there's going to be some sort of conflict in any of these decisions that they have to make, and that's 402.176B. And there are both unique opportunities, and there's some obligation in there for us to act in the child's best interest and make sure that these things are getting in front of the court when they should, or that we're confronting the Department of the CBC in order to access these funds, in order to get things that these children need that either they're just not being provided, or you're getting that same old issue of the department saying, we just don't have the money. If the money is there and you know the money is there, you can access it, again, to get things for the children. That's pretty clear under 402.17. When you're looking for what things can you access for the children, the short answer to that is for their current and long-term needs. definitions of what those are found in the administrative code under Rule 65C.002, subsections 3 and subsection 7. And to go through that, just so you know, it's the cost of providing particular residential services, expenses for medical, psychological, psychiatric, or dental treatment, which cannot provided looking at other sources that we know about, including Medicaid. Personal comfort items is a big one, and that includes things like clothing, radios, television, tape players, alarm clocks, books, art supplies, sports equipment, those sorts of things. And there can be other expenses included in current needs that the district administrator is willing to say is included in that. It's very broad, that category of current needs. So case coordinators, when you're out there frustrated about not being able to get certain things, if you know there's money in trust, then, you know, there's a way to, that we can push on that in court, or you can push the department of the CBC in order to get that for you if it's not being done. Under long-term needs, the thing to remember about that is that what is included in long-term needs is independent living expenses, things like security deposits, telephone, utilities, apartment furniture, driver's license fees, any of those things. While they appear to be current needs for an independent living child, they are actually under the definition of long-term needs. It's not really relevant in terms of knowing that you can access it, but if you have to refer to the rule by chapter and verse, you'll find it under long-term, not current needs. The other thing that I would like to say to you at this point is, again, we're going to go through some things here, and we're going to probably go through them pretty rapidly because we only have an hour. But, you know, we're going to drill into these things in more detail with some additional training that's going to follow. And, again, we have some folks out there who've done a really good job at accessing these things for children. I've got two examples are particularly in the 18th Circuit. We've done a wonderful job there. We have a volunteer there. His name's Jim Daly. He has worked with the program and just done some absolutely wonderful things in terms of making sure that these children get access to their trust accounts for their needs. One of the things that has been done there that's really impressive is that there's something called a personal allowance that children are supposed to have. And I think most of us have heard of the foster care allowance and personal allowance. And you can find a definition of what the child's personal allowance is under Rule 65C-17.0029. And that is supposed to be, by definition, under the definition in that section, it's $15 a month. And the district administrator for the department can increase that at their discretion. And for example, in District 7, where the 18th Circuit is, that has been increased. The last memo I saw in 2006, that has been increased to $40. They do a good job of letting the department know they're going to access or try to increase the amount for the personal need there in the 18th Circuit. It's my understanding that everybody just comes to the court hearing with the form to access it. It's signed at the court hearing in many instances, and the money is distributed in that fashion. And it's my understanding there's no need to even have a court order with it, which is very good, a good way to handle that. We have another a situation recently where Mary Kay Wimsett was able to, in two situations, and we'll talk about something called the fee waiver here in a moment, was able to access the child's trust account in terms of getting a fee waiver, being the fee that the Department of Children and Families can assess for the child's foster care. But she got this fee waiver to get, for example, I believe they were both developmental disabilities children, to get massage therapy for one child, and then to get a fairly expensive wheelchair for another child. Mary Kay, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
I think that you those two items, I believe, were classified as were they classified as current or long-term needs?
The problem was the child actually needed, with the wheelchair, he needed two wheelchairs, and Medicaid, you know, only buy one every 5 years, and he had outgrown both his power chair and his push chair. So we were able to get Medicaid to buy the power chair, which is obviously significantly more, and then the cost of care we got waived to purchase the push chair. And then the other child, and this is something that a lot of you probably, it's the may encounter with your disabled kids, the massage therapy has been cut by med waiver, so we were able to get that paid for privately through, you know, again, waiving the cost of care. So you may want to look at that. I know, I'm fairly certain that that is statewide, that their med waiver is no longer covering massage therapy, and it previously covered it weekly for a lot of these kids.
Okay, and those are just two, and that's very good, Mary Kay, and those are just two examples of, or three examples actually, of the, you know, the things that we can do, you know, with these children's trust accounts, and if you are aware that there are that there is trust account money available in terms of accessing services and items that the children need. In moving along here, in terms of what our expectations are, here regarding these trust accounts issues and moving into this this area, the training that the Legal Aid Society provided, I felt like Jim and Bill and John did a very did a good job in a very big picture way of talking about the benefits. And as you know, if you've reviewed the training, a majority of these funds it's going to come from SSI, so it's going to come from government benefits, and so the application of those is very critical, and make sure that the CBC, the department, has applied appropriately to get the child benefits. That is almost another conversation in and of itself. And so what we're trying to accomplish here today is to focus you on what our expectations are when a child has money in trust, and you know, the things that we need to do to start drilling in and dealing with this in a way that you know, try to give you some perspective on it, so that when you're dealing with all of the cases that you have, you can have these things in your mind as you're rolling through them. So with this training, we've provided you with something called a Master Trust Practice Steps for GAL attorneys. This is really, I mean, that's almost a misnomer, you know, to me, because it's for attorneys, and it's what we are instructing the attorneys that they're going to have to be questioning or asking during staffings and when they're at court appearances in order to drill into these issues. But case coordinators and volunteers are that's where all of this is going to happen, out in the field, and where we can discover all of this out in the field, other than standing in front of a judge and asking the judge to inquire about it. So, you know, you've been provided with those, and those are coming in other practice areas too. You know, that's sort of our expectation in terms of what we're looking for in this area. Now, when you look at the Master Trust area, you've got to look at a couple of different areas. As always, it's never all located neatly in the same place, so you've got to navigate a couple of different rule areas. 402 of Florida Statutes .17 is utilized. And then there's part of the administrative codes, which, you know, are available online. And again, we'll provide you with all of this following the call. Chapter 65C-6, Chapter 65C-17 of the administrative code. And then, of course, Department CFOP, their operating procedure, which is online, and which we provided a hard copy to every office out there should have one. 175-59 and 55-7, those are currently under revision as well. In addition, you'll find some accounting procedures which are online for the department when you drill very deep into it. And again, I'm just giving you the overall lay of where it's all found. We can drill into these issues more specifically in later trainings. But their accounting procedures manual is online. Volume seven, chapter 3 and 6 are where the master trust issues are referenced in that publication. You know, when you're out there dealing with the ball bouncing back and forth between DCF and the CBCs, Remember that DCF will serve as the trustee, have that fiduciary responsibility unless they specifically contract that service to the CBCs in your area. And in some places, what we found is they have, and in some places, they haven't. So, just bear that in mind as you, your director, and your supervising attorneys are dealing with these issues, and management out there in that on a higher level. What I'd like to do now is just go over these practice steps with you just a little bit, go over them individually, and give you some guidance as to what individual items you will find when you staff them or when you think about them in this way. If you look at the first one here, does the child qualify for benefits such as Social Security income or have financial assets at all? I mean, I think, again, I think that from a big perspective now, a big picture point of view, I think that the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach did a pretty good job. I think Jim and John and Bill did a good job of just laying out the issues that can be associated with acquiring benefits and applying for them. My first point out of this would be, does the child have money in trust? Does the child have money that should be in trust? Is there money in trust? That's the first question you need to ask yourself. And there's really two ways of determining whether that's true. The first thing that you need to be aware of is under the Department Operating Procedure, under 175-59, and it's in Chapter 7B, the department needs to notify the court and the parties that they do have money in trust and they're holding money in trust. There's a special form that they have to fill out that's called a notarized designation of client money and property. And what the operating procedure tells us is that the department should be filing this form to give us notice and to give the court notice and to give the child notice that a trust account has been set up. The other way that you can that you will be able to determine whether or not a trust account has been set up for a child or a subtrust has been set up is that we mentioned this a little bit earlier. The department is entitled to take a fee out of money received by the children to pay for child care. And they can take this fee legitimately under 402.17189. Gives them the ability to propound rules to take it out. But they have to give notice that they're going to do that. The area that you can find or the rule that applies to the notice is under 65C-6.002. And the way that they need to provide this notice is through Form 285D. 285D is the form that's used for the notice that, hey, you've got money coming in. We think we're entitled to a fee. Here's the fee we're going to assess. Now, 285D is very important because it not only gives you notice, but it also provides you the form to request the fee waiver. And so this form under 65C-17, I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you, but this one's important to us because under 65C-17.0051, that notice needs to go to the guardian ad litem as well as the child. So under that rule, we are specifically mentioned in terms of the notice. So if you're in an area where you're not receiving notice of trust accounts, and they're not filing the designation, if they're taking money, they definitely must be providing us with this notice under this rule. So there are absolutely ways that you have to access, and there are and they are required to provide notice that the trust account is open, and this is over and apart from the accountings that have to be attached to the JR, which is something we all seem to be familiar with. Now, I mentioned that you have, and we'll talk more about the fee in a minute. But we mentioned that there are sub trust accounts that must be set up. Just And I think that the previous training probably laid this out for you, but this whole master trust thing came about back in the 90s out of a lawsuit. I won't get into the details of that, but there was an order that, an actual court order that created it, and then statute picked it up and sort of codified it as well. But it's a huge master trust, but out of it, when the money comes in, sub-accounts have to be set up for your individual children. Now, there are several different types of sub-accounts that the department can set up. They're important in from a big picture point of view. The main reason why I feel they're important to know the distinction is because when you're dealing with this government benefit money, Medicaid has a cap of $2,000 that can be retained at any given time in the account. And what happens when you exceed the cap, money goes back to Social Security. So what you want to do is either they should be looking for accounts that don't have the cap, or we need to be effectively requesting a spending of the money for the child's needs so that money doesn't get reverted. I'll just tick off what the accounts are, but the only ones that we're really talking about today that I'd like to drill into a little bit are current needs and long-term needs account. Both of those are subject to the cap. In addition to that, there's also something called PASS account. Now, with a PASS account, you have both the disabled and the non-disabled variety. Under the non-disabled account, it's subject to the cap. If it's a disabled PASS account, it's not subject to the cap of $2,000. And what a PASS account is a plan for attaining economic self-sufficiency, I believe, is the handle for that. Primarily, when you're looking at children transitioning into adulthood, independent living, your independent living kids, those are the ones that would be looking at PASS accounts. In addition to that, there's a disabled special needs accounts for children with disabilities. There's something called an SSI lump sum distribution account, a Medicaid income trust account, and an individual development account, IDA, which some of you might have heard about. Again, those are all of the accounts, but by far and away what we see most of from at least up here are current needs accounts and some long-term needs accounts. As you drill into it, I think you'll find that probably some more disabled special needs trust accounts need to be set up. I mean, ideally, what we would look in the long term to be involved with is some involvement with the department or the CBC worker when they're setting up these accounts. Because again, when they've identified money coming in, the first thing that they're supposed to do is they're supposed to move to start determining which of these accounts need to be set up, and then giving the designation of that they've got the money and property. And so if we could get some input on that, I think that would be best case scenario, long-term picture for us. When you're just getting back to the fee waiver for a moment, again, what the fee waiver is, really, you can think about it as the department at CBC's ability to take money out of the trust account to pay for foster care. Let me just throw the numbers at you, and you'll see the issue right here. Currently, the monthly amount that a child receives from SSI is right around $636 a month. Well, son of a gun, wouldn't you know it, that the cost of foster care costs about $606 a month. So, what's set up here is the ability to basically take all of the money that's coming in from SSI and pay for the cost of care. So, for example, when Mary Kay is talking to you about what she did in terms of getting the massage therapy and the wheelchair, what she did was that she went in and told them that, look, this kid needs these things, which we have no other source of income for, and so before you take your fee of $606 this month, you pay this, pay for these items. And I believe the wheelchair was something like $4,000, if I'm wrong, or if I think I'm right about that. Anyway, so that also illustrates that the fee waiver can be a one-time deal, it can be a one-month deal, or it can be ongoing. And so that's something that has to be determined. Now, I'll just slide in here that this is a good place from our point of view to use pro bono attorneys, attorney ad litems. We can provide training to get them in here to start looking at these issues. It gets into a separate issue that requires some detailed work, possibly some detailed legal work, which could lead to a DOA hearing, an administrative hearing that is a separate legal, which most of you know is a separate legal proceeding altogether, really. But just following this waiver trail here for a moment, some of the bigger picture problems that some of you might face is that when the department is thinking about granting waivers, the first thing that they have to do is the district administrator has to set up a panel to analyze these waiver requests, and that's under 65C-6.022(2). And this panel, this committee, is the ones that apply the criteria under the administrative code in order to determine if a particular fee waiver request should be granted. What we found in most regions is that we haven't seen the establishment of the committee, and so that's a good first thing that you're going to have to deal with, and your program's going to have to deal with. I mean, have they even established the committee to deal with these waiver requests coming in? Also, I'll share with you. The department, is supposed to have someone designated that is the master trust individual in the region. I don't know that they have that established, or I don't know that they always know who that might be. We will continue to try to put together a list for you to find out who your regional master trust contact person might be and provide that to your circuit director and supervising attorney. Some of the things the committee has to balance, and these are pretty broad things: express preference of the child, they have to consider the age, health status and needs, status of the case, things like that, which are listed under 65C-17.004. Those are the things that they have to consider. But if they arbitrarily, or if they have not fully considered those things, or it's believed otherwise, they have not decided it consistent with the law, a denial of the waiver, that is, children have 21 days from the date of the denial to request an administrative hearing on these matters. And some of you that are familiar with it, this isn't a fair hearing, it's a DOA hearing. So there's due process protections that are provided in this review hearing. And that you can find that right under 65C-17.005 subparagraph 5. The one thing that I'd like to, as a side note here, point out to you at this point is we were pretty happy to see that a group of child advocates, based on last year's legislative changes to the based on the fact that there last year we had a new administration that came into the Department of Children and Families, and these people, the current administration, feel that some children have not been fairly noticed of their right to have an administrative review hearing of a denial of a waiver. Some child advocates, led primarily by Deborah Schroe, the North Florida Legal Services, Deborah's done a lot of work with this, have accessed the Florida Bar Foundation in order to put together a group of pro bono attorneys that would help children get review of the denials. Now, I want to be, just so I'm clear with you, this, what I'm talking to you about right now is only when a child is denied a waiver. And the Florida Bar Foundation, Deborah Schroe, and North Florida Legal Services have taken the point on trying to get children representation. We were at meetings with them, and we being the GAL have agreed to help them get the notices to the children. You'll be hearing more about that. Something that we forwarded to your supervising attorneys was an invitation to a web training that Deborah Schroth is putting on, which will be delivered in part by Mary Clark, Deputy General Counsel, on Thursday. And this training this training is directed to the pro bono attorneys that... potentially represent these children when they're denied the waiver. So we've encouraged our supervising attorneys to at least be in attendance so they know what's going on with that. And I just wanted to put that out there. But, you know, the bigger picture for us is, are the waivers being filed for and, appropriately, are they being reviewed consistent with the rules by DCF and the CBCs? The thing that the department really wants to do is they would like to have the caseworker apply for the waiver, but they have that dual role responsibility, so when they'll apply, I haven't at this point heard of the Department of Children and Families or the CBCs applying for the waiver. I'm sure it's happening somewhere out there. We haven't got feedback on that just yet. So that's really dealing with the issue of do the children have a trust account, types of trust accounts they've set up, and the notice and what to do or what's supposed to occur in theory when this waiver notice and right to waiver comes about. In terms of moving, if you move to the third bullet point, has the department attached the county of the child's trust account to the judicial review report? This is the one I think that we all know, should be occurring. Two things with that. Number one, first of all, I've heard in some places they have a notice, they have their notice of trust account maybe in the JR. And then I've heard there's a summary of trust account attached to the JR. And I can tell you under 39701-6A3, that is not good enough. What needs to be attached to that JR is a full accounting. Now, when you say full accounting, and I've seen these things, and the ones that I have looked at, does everybody have their phone on mute out there? That might cause that problem. The thing that you need to think about this is I don't feel as though these things are like building rockets out there. I think that, for the most part, it's like looking at your checkbook ledger as opposed to looking at some quarterly report from IBM on their financial condition. I mean, what needs to be in there is the monies that, your starting point for the trust account, when and what the amount was, the accountings of when monies have come in to the trust account and gone out of the trust account, and what for what purpose. And from that, then, you could be able to see what was remaining in the trust account, what the trust account money has been spent on to date, and get a good feel for what you're working with there, the monies that you possibly have to work with to achieve the child's current and long-term needs. One thing I would say is if they're not attached, and this was covered a bit in Jim, Bill, and John's presentation, but they did talk about if it's not attached, I would move to continue the hearing. That's good leverage for you. Let them know ahead of time. We need these things attached. We need the full accountings attached. I leverage them in that way. I mean, you're going to have to be a cog in the wheel there before you get something done. Look to current and long-term needs. Again, the personal allowance will come up when you're reviewing this. Again, it's our intent to provide more specific training, possibly more in-service training on reviewing these accountings and more specific things that you can do with them. The last thing that I'll talk to you about, and the last bullet point we have on here, and I know the spin down bullet is in there, but that's really consumed under the accounting portion of it. But the last portion is transitioning the money to the children when they turn 18. And this is another instance where, in the 18th Circuit, this came up, and they hit this issue head on. And, Tom actually is probably not on the call today because he's writing a brief dealing with this subject. But in some instances, the department doesn't want to return the money to the child directly or send the money to the child directly. They want to return it to the Social Security Administration. The long and the short of it, I can give you as an example of why that would be, is in their best interest, in the state's best interest in preserving funds, let's say that they have accidentally taken funds out of the child's trust account for cost of care when they shouldn't have. If they send it back to Social Security, Social Security won't make a distinction about who they take the money from. They will just reduce the amount of money that was taken out of the account by the inappropriate disbursement for cost of care and then forward it to the child. And so then the child is really taking a double hit. Had the money taken out when it shouldn't have been because it should have been waived, and then taken out again because Social Security wants its money. And so that money should have rightfully come from the department. So there's a preservation of funds issue there for the state. This is why when they're moving the money to the child, when the child turns 18, the conversations that we have had with the executive office of the department and the general counsel's office are that they will not object to money going directly to the child if we motion and bring it in front of the court. It is our position that they have an obligation to do everything they can to try to get the money directly to the child. Because to have to wait months for the money to go back to Social Security and come back to the child after they turn 18, it's just obvious it creates a problem for children that are desperately in need of money when they're going out in the world for the first time trying to make their way. So that's a very big issue in terms of getting the money to the children. You need to be requesting that they get the money at least 6 months prior to the child transitioning out of care. The staffing when the child turns 17 might be a good point to file the motion on that and to get that order signed. But that would be the most significant practice point in that particular point. Now, that was a very fast one-hour run-through, in my estimation, of the more specifics in the master trust area, trying to attach those to these practice steps that you have in front of you. Again, we're going to work on some specific things to give to you that will give you these sites and things that I have mentioned and give your attorneys, direction in terms of where to find the authority so that, you case coordinators and volunteers can go out there and let the department know you know about this and that you are going after it. And I want to encourage you to call us, and we will stop what we're doing. And it's not like we're geniuses up here. I'm telling you, the department and these folks have not drilled into these issues in most places. So there's a lot of fresh, unsettled law and issues with all of this stuff. And so I think it behooves us to just put all our heads together and try to generate something that, that we can defend on, if we have to go the appellate route, which I don't think we're going to have to most of the time, honestly, once you start drilling into it. But, if you call us, we'll help and put together, even if we've got to send somebody down there. I mean, we will put together what you need to address this issue with you. And we will all work together on it. But you've got to get in there and start being the cog. And when you refer back to these practice steps that you have in front of you, those are the questions that you need to be asking yourself. And then these things that we've just touched on, and I'm going to stress that to you, that we've just really touched on today, you really need to be throwing them out there and creating the fights on these issues so that we can get to the bottom of it. I mean, it is undoubtedly that your judge won't like some of it, and it is undoubtedly that in some points he might be right. But the point is that we need to try and argue these things to the best interest of the children that we have, and we need you guys to go in there and start creating a ruckus about it. So with that in mind, I'm really glad so many of you turned out for this training. If some of you want more, that's good. We're going to follow it up with more. If you've got individual questions or if you've got some ideas or things that you want, don't hesitate to contact us, call us, or send us emails. I mean, you can contact any of us, myself, Don Marie, Kristen Kruger, Liz Damsky, Mary Kay, Tom, Mary Clark. I mean, you can contact any of us, and we'll be able to put together what it is you need to go out there and do your job. So thanks again for calling in.